The people of Vernon and East Los Angeles are entitled to work, live, and raise their children in a neighborhood where they do not have to fear that a polluter may have contaminated their air, ground, and water. The pollution associated with the Exide facility has gone on far too long, and that ends today.
U.S. Attorney Stephanie Yonakura announcing that after more than 90 years, the Vernon Battery Recycling Plant, a few miles from downtown L.A., is shutting down for good. It was a notorious polluter for nearly a century. It dumped lead and arsenic into the air and ground, sometimes spilling battery acid onto streets. Now, after years of complaints and federal investigations, Exide, the company that operates the plant, has made a deal to demolish the plant, and it's agreed to pay for the cleanup, estimated to cost at least $50 million. But under the agreement, the company will not be prosecuted. So for more on the story, we're joined now by Tony Barbosa. He's an environment reporter for the LA Times. He's been covering this story for a long time. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, residents and activists have been fighting this plant for a very long time. What's the reaction today?
It's kind of a mixed reaction. There's a sense of relief and happiness that a facility that the community has been opposed to and fighting for its closure for many years now, that it will finally be shut down. At the same time, there is some disappointment that Exide, the Georgia-based company that has operated it since the year 2000, that it or its executives will not face criminal charges.
Right, and that certainly was a question or a complaint brought up by Senate President Pro Tem Kevin De Leon. He represents the area. Let's hear a clip of tape from him.
The facility was allowed to operate without a permit for decades, leaking lead, arsenic, and other hazardous waste materials into the streets where children play.
Without a permit, really? Why were they allowed to continue to operate by state officials?
Now, the state had them operating under an interim permit for several decades. And their explanation is that they were recently reviewing an application, and they said as recently as this week that they had decided to initiate a denial of their permit and that they were moving to shut them down as well. On now, news of the agreement with federal officials broke on Wednesday, and that was driven by an agreement with the company to shut the facility down in exchange for their avoiding criminal prosecution.
So could there then be further state action, or does that end that?
What will happen now is the state will oversee a cleanup of the site. It's about a 15-acre site. It's in an industrial area of Vernon, and they've said that over the next 2 years they will oversee a cleanup that will demolish the building, you know, all the structures on the site, and then also, you know, in the years to come, will be cleaning up lead-contaminated soil from dozens, perhaps hundreds of homes in surrounding communities like Boyle Heights and Maywood.
Well, so do we even know the extent of the environmental damage to the surrounding area?
What the state says is that the site itself requires further testing once they demolish the buildings, and they're actually in the process of testing homes kind of expanding out from that area. So the tests are still ongoing, and I don't think at this point the state has a full sense of the extent of the contamination and then also how much it will cost. The director of the Department of Toxic Substances Control told reporters yesterday that the cleanup could cost $50 million, but it could also exceed that, you know, costing much more than that.
Well, can Exide pay that? Because I think it's in bankruptcy now.
Now, right? Federal officials, when they announced this on Thursday, they said that the reason they came to this agreement was that under Exide's bankruptcy proceedings, if there was the threat of criminal prosecution, the company had a very high likelihood of being liquidated, leaving no one to pay for the cleanup but taxpayers.
Right. And so without the prosecution, will it confidently be able to pay this $50 million plus to clean it up?
Well, what the Department of Justice says is that as part of this agreement, there's something that they kind of refer to as a hammer provision, which says that over the next 10 years, if the company does not comply with its cleanup obligations, it can be prosecuted for a series of felonies that they've already admitted to in this agreement. So they say that will ensure that A, the company will stay intact so that it can pay for its cleanup obligations, and then B, will be forced to do that under the threat of criminal prosecution.
Okay, so maybe it can actually pay for it, but do we trust this plant to be able to do it in a way that we want to see it done, given all the lapses over the years in terms of how they transported and stored this hazardous material?
Well, that's a good question. When you speak to a lot of community members and groups who have been pointing to these violations for a long time, they are definitely, you know, they and elected officials are casting a lot of doubt now on how satisfactorily this cleanup can go ahead, being under the oversight of the same agency that allowed the facility to operate with a series of violations for that long.
And what has been the effect on the residents themselves in terms of health problems? This has been going on, as we said, for many decades. Have there been noticeable health effects?
Yes. Well, the facility has operated in the same location since 1922, so it's been there for decades. And I think if you talk to residents, they'll tell you that they're just worried. They're worried that some of the health effects that they've observed in them and their children, especially, may have something to do with the amount of lead and arsenic and other chemicals that this plant had been releasing over decades. So, you know, they're seeing their neighbors' front and backyards having soil removed. They within the last year or two, they've residents in areas near the plant have gotten notices advising them not to eat vegetables from their gardens or allow their children to play in the soil. So there's a lot of worry that lead, which of course is a highly toxic substance that we've known about for hundreds of years, that lead could be damaging their health.
Tony Barboza, environment reporter for the LA Times, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, people are still driving cars, of course, here in Southern California. Those cars use batteries. So what's going to happen with all those batteries now that the Exide plant is closed? Where will they be recycled? Mark Murray is the executive director of Californians Against Waste, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Okay, so Exide was a big car battery recycler, and I believe it was one of just two in the western part of the United States. So what happens now?
Well, I mean, certainly this is hopefully the beginning of an end of a very bad story in terms of environmental impact on the residents in Los Angeles. But we're part of the problem. We generate some 10 million of these automobile batteries in California alone every year. And there's only one other facility in the United States on the western part of the United States. It is also in Los Angeles. And the rest of the batteries that we generate in California are being shipped to Mexico. American plants are now moving the battery recycling operations to Mexico, where there are less regulation. So we've got to do a better job of taking responsibility for all of those lead-acid batteries that we all use, that we all count on to keep our cars going, and we're going to have to pay the cost of making sure that they're managed properly here rather than exporting our problem overseas.
And are they managed properly in that other recycler in the City of Industry?
Well, you know, I mean, these batteries contain lead, they contain arsenic, and they contain, you know, a dozen other chemicals that are hazardous and that are banned from disposal in landfill. Even that facility has had issues over the years with arsenic leaking out and other materials. Now, they have made the investment in containing their air quality standards. They have a permit that is in operation right now. And so as far as we know, they are doing everything the way they're supposed to be doing it. But right now, they don't have sufficient capacity to contain and recycle all of the batteries, all of the lead acid batteries that we generate here in California from just driving our cars. So we've got to do something, and it doesn't mean that that problem just goes away. It means we're exporting that problem to Mexico, we're exporting that problem to Canada, and to other places where the rules aren't as strict.
So 10 million batteries, is that 10 million batteries a year?
10 million batteries a year,
and
automobile batteries a year in California.
How many of those are now or will be exported to Mexico?
Well, you know, just to say that we have a fantastic collection rate in terms of keeping those batteries out of the landfill, collecting them for recycling. But the about a third of those batteries were being recycled at Exide, about a third at the Cumetco facility in Los Angeles, and about a third were being exported. So now we're hoping that Cumetco can increase their capacity, but basically we're going to be sending two-thirds of our batteries that we generate here in California, we're going to be sending those to Mexico to facilities that, in our view, are as bad as the Exide facility.
And so they're polluting their neighborhoods and the towns surrounding them.
Exactly.
To the same extent or worse?
Well, you know, again, your guess is as good as mine in terms of what kind of regulations are in place in Mexico at the various facilities in Mexico. Those facilities are run by an American company, Johnson Controls, which is a manufacturer of batteries. So, we hope that they're doing the best job that they can, but we don't know that. We know that the rules are more laxed in Mexico. So the solution to this problem is not to stop recycling. I mean, the only thing that's worse than the recycling situation at Exide would be if we were to throw these batteries away in disposal facilities in California and elsewhere. What we've got to do is take responsibility for making the investment in the front end to make sure that we have facilities that can properly manage that. And that may mean an increased cost for the batteries at the front end, an increased cost to us as consumers to make sure that we're not exporting our pollution to Mexico and other places.
So what do you mean? You mean we should actually be building more recycling facilities for these batteries and making sure that they're operating properly?
You know, that is the answer. We do need to build facilities in California that are the best in the world in terms of recycling these. We can't just, you know, out of sight, out of mind, export them to a country that isn't going to have the same rules that we have. That's not a solution.
Right. And as you said, though, even the other facility, which has a better record than the Exide plant, even that has problems recycling them in an environmentally friendly way. Is it even possible to do that, given all the noxious chemicals involved in these batteries?
Well, you know, yes, it's possible to manufacture these batteries in the first place without polluting the environment. What we're basically doing in a recycling operation is deconstructing those batteries. And if we make the same level of investment in recycling the batteries that we're putting into manufacturing the batteries in the first place, we should be able to do it in a way that is safe for workers, safe for the environment, and doesn't create the kind of toxic legacy that we have in this Vernon situation. So, but that means we may have to pay more for our batteries. We can't be in love with our automobiles and not take responsibility for the toxic and environmental impacts associated with them.
Mark Murray, Executive Director of Californians Against Waste. Thanks, folks, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right. Do you have batteries all over your house, not just lead, but others? Have you tried using rechargeables? Do you recycle? Do you not? You're supposed to. You're not supposed to put them in the garbage. Tell us what you do with your batteries. Your battery stories on Twitter or on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, celebrity novelist Karl Ove Knausgård is famous for his multi-volume memoir/novels called My Struggle. The New York Times thought it would be interesting to get his take on America, so they gave him a plum assignment, but he messes it up at the beginning, which meant that his photographer became a major part of the story. I'll talk with that photographer next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry, you can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A depressed Norwegian writer, an enthusiastic young American photographer, a road trip through the Midwest. It sounds like the plot of an indie comedy, but it's not. It's real. The New York Times hired the writer Karl Ove Knausgård to write a two-part travel piece in North America. Knausgård is famous for his six-volume memoir, labeled novels called My Struggle, in which seemingly every detail of his life is recorded. It's caused quite a stir in Norway and Sweden for revealing a lot of intimate details about friends and family. The second part of Knausgård's U.S. travelogue is published in the New York Times Magazine this weekend. And it's less about America than it is about Knausgård and his own struggles to report the piece. Perhaps unwittingly, the photographer assigned to take pictures for the story ended up being a major character in it. His name is Peter von Ochtmal, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, when you first got this assignment, did you know who Karl Ove was?
I did know who he was. I'd read a brief article about him at some point and actually picked up the first volume of his book and read about 15 pages of it. So I loosely knew who he was, but I didn't know the depths of his work, certainly.
And you weren't really supposed to be traveling with him, right? You were supposed to just take pictures after he had done his voyage?
Yeah, exactly. I was coming out of a really busy period and was exhausted. But when he wasn't able to get his new license and he was kind of stuck in Newfoundland, the Times cooked up the plan that we would go together.
So the first part of this two-parter, he basically chronicles his ineptitude. He loses his license. He can't get a license. He's stuck in this hotel. It goes on and on. And so then you arrive, and I guess you texted each other beforehand, and this is what he had to say about it. I'll just quote from that. He says, "I also had a hunch that the photographer was, in many respects, my total opposite. We had exchanged some text messages about where to go and what to see. The first thing he had written to me was this: 'Hey, man, it's Peter, the NYT photographer, texting you, so you have my number. Inshallah, this message comes through. Safe travels. Inshallah.'" So he seemed perplexed by you.
Yeah. I was actually just reading, maybe mistakenly, some comments on the piece, and apparently inshallah was considered a new hipster mannerism or something like that. And I do it kind of subconsciously. I've spent the last 10 years working in the Middle East, and it's a word that in Arabic, there's an English equivalent, but it's not really used or doesn't quite have the same meaning in common conversation as the Arabic version. And so I just tend to sort of say it constantly. And he was kind of understandably baffled by where that was coming from.
Well, were you surprised that you ended up being such a big character in his stories?
I was surprised, but which is pretty idiotic in retrospect, because that's what he writes about, essentially his own kind of personal meditations on his life and these places. And most of it was okay with me. Some of it, you know, all the scheming to not get caught smoking cigarettes in places where we shouldn't. I was kind of like, oh man, it made me seem a little bit glib, and I wasn't totally thrilled by that. But in the end, you know, it was accurate. And actually, the most interesting part about it for me was it got me thinking a lot about my own process of taking pictures and how, you know, every portrait I take is kind of as much a self-portrait as it is a portrait of the individual. You know, I sort of want that creative license because it feels instinctual, and as does he. And so, you know, who was it? You know, how could I be one that could kind of quash, you know, the integrity of his process, which I think is really courageous in a lot of ways and truthful. So it was an interesting kind of personal growth opportunity.
So do you think you're going to read his books now?
Yeah, I'm about halfway through the first book now. And have been enjoying it a lot. I mean, there are parts that I find excruciatingly boring. There are a lot of parts that I find completely unique and beautiful. I mean, I love to read, and I always have, and I have a lot of respect for the guy, I have to say. I mean, it's interesting, a man who essentially has lived a very different kind of life, which has been dominated a lot by travel and kind of engaging the outside world and adventure, for lack of a better word, and he's someone that's stuck very close to home and led a bit more of a life at home and with children and things like that. And yet at the same time, it's just as courageous as anyone who's going into a war zone to expose the depths of their soul like that. You know, I find it startling and profound, because I haven't read it quite to that extent, and I can see why people would be furious with him. And at the same time, and I was slightly annoyed at different points too, but at the same time, I gotta say, I respect the process.
What were you most annoyed by, aside from the smoking part?
No, it was just, it was basically just like the smoking and things like that. Because you know, everyone wants to see themselves as a more clever, complex, intelligent character than maybe serves the purpose of a certain narrative. And so there's a part of me that felt like a prop a little bit. And I thought, you know, well, is this, you know, I asked him this directly. I was like, is this really how you think of me after the first part? And he seemed quite upset that I was offended. I'd sent him an email that a friend of mine had sent me that's like, it's interesting how well, you know, this guy captures, you know, your mannerisms and your voice, but it seems like, you know, an imposter wearing a Pete mask rather than, you know, Pete himself. And so there was that aspect of it. And my parents kind of were a little bit freaked out by my characterization as well. And, you know, he was apologetic and legitimately didn't think that I'd come across badly, and actually most of my friends didn't think so either. And I have to say, in the second part, I was really happy with the way I turned out.
In the second part, he wrote that he told you things he'd never told anyone. He said, normally it took me years to trust people. Peter, I trusted after a few hours. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, it did. Maybe it was part of the circumstances. You know, we're in this car together for long periods of time, driving through the night, you know, very few lights, just one another for company. And at the same time, you know, there's this, as I quickly learned how open he was and kind of courageous with his own vulnerabilities and painful memories and reflections about himself, it kind of encouraged me to do the same. And so I think that response, kind of hurtling through the night and talking intimately about the things that we were proud of, the things that we felt ashamed of, it created that kind of bond of intimacy.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Peter von Ochtemal. He's a photographer with Magnum Photos, and he photographed novelist Karl Ove Knausgård's two-part series, My Journey, for the New York Times. The second installment of the story and pictures now online, and it'll be published in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Coming up on the program, the story of a small group of anti-Vietnam War activists who decided to break into their local FBI office to find documents that prove the FBI was spying on Americans. How that break-in changed everything after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks to Edward Snowden, we all now know about the NSA's massive electronic spying program. Although it's kind of surprising how many people seem to have responded to these revelations with really just a shoulder shrug. We were a lot more shockable back in 1971. That was the year when a group broke into a small FBI office in Pennsylvania and exposed documents about a program called COINTELPRO that would eventually stun the nation. COINTELPRO was J. Edgar Hoover's systematic campaign of spying and intimidation against civil rights activists, anti-war protesters, and other undesirables such as Albert Einstein. The documents, as well as the Watergate break-in a year later, would lead to restrictions on the government's spying activities. Now, the people who broke into that FBI office have come forward. They're in a new documentary. It's called 1971.
I knew that we would find things in that office that were not only immoral, but probably illegal.
We knew that if we got caught, we were going to probably face very serious prison time.
It was very empowering to know that ordinary people could actually take action.
Joanna Hamilton is the director of 1971, and she's in studio with me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us more about this small band of protesters who decided to take action and break into the small FBI office. They were already protesters, anti-war protesters.
They were, yeah, broadly already, all of them politically active. They were a group of eight. One was a social worker, a couple were professors, one was a mom.
And why did they think that they needed to break into this office? What did they want to accomplish?
They surmised through their political activities that the FBI was in all likelihood spying on dissent at this point in time. And they thought, well, if the FBI is trying to curtail our ability to disagree with the government, it's as important to expose that as it is to demand an end to the war. They also thought that, you know, J. Edgar Hoover at that point in time was all powerful, and he was really the sort of shadow president.
The America we live in today must awaken to the danger. A tidal wave of lawless tyranny is now surging forth from the criminal and subversive underworld.
He was answerable to no one in government. And so it was on that basis that they thought no one in Washington is going to hold him accountable. So it was really an act of last resort.
And they thought in the small office in Media, Pennsylvania, there would be smoking guns?
They had no idea, to be honest. So they risked everything, potentially for nothing. Bill Davidon, the leader of the group, who was a professor at Haverford College, thought that sort of the little that they did know about Hoover was that he was, you know, his reputation was that he was a consummate bureaucrat. So they imagined that there might be documents that spelled this out. But it was still a hunch, and they broke in, loaded all the documents into suitcases and then into trunks of cars and drove away, and over a period of days sorted through the documents, but very quickly they showed up documents that proved exactly that.
Tell us about the woman in the group, Bonnie Raines. She's a mother, and she and her husband both decided to do this, to be a part of this group, and she was the one who was assigned to case the joint before the break-in.
Yeah. A young woman, she posed as a Swarthmore student going in. At the time, the FBI was just contemplating hiring their first female agents. So that was a sort of ruse under which she went into the office to do her interview with the head agent.
And she and her husband, John, they have a conversation, or maybe many conversations, about whether or not they should do this, given the fact that they have three small children.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine having that conversation. It must be an extraordinarily difficult conversation to have.
We felt that just because we were parents didn't mean that we could remove ourselves from responsibility, that would have been kind of a cop-out. We decided that we weren't going to be content when we continued to see things that really disturbed us. Obviously, we had to think about the worst case scenario, which would be that we would be arrested, tried, convicted, and sentenced to federal prison. So we did talk to John's older brother, Bob, and his wife about what would happen to the children should we be put in prison. We had to know for sure that they would be cared for by family.
Okay, so they do the burglary. They get in, they get the documents, and they get out. They get out scot-free.
Right. I mean, totally improbably. You know, they actually manage to break in. And they get out of the building, load the suitcases into cars and drive away. And
nobody saw them.
Nobody saw them.
Astonishing. So in this day, you know, you think, cameras are everywhere.
That's right. That's right.
That couldn't happen today.
Today, it wouldn't happen.
And when did they first realize that they had an incredible amount of damaging information?
Almost immediately. As they describe it, that very night, they started to sift through the documents.
But it didn't take very long before I remember somebody hollering in one of the rooms where we were sorting, "You've got to come and look at this."
I kind of assumed that all the illegal stuff would be, you know, nobody in their right mind would keep a written record of that. Apparently, I was mistaken about that.
And they came across one document in particular. I mean, obviously, they stole 1,000 documents, but one document that sprang out almost immediately that they all remember. It was a directive from the local Philadelphia FBI office that instructed agents to make citizens believe to step up their level of interrogation of activists in such a way as to make them believe that there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. So it was really to foster an atmosphere of paranoia.
And that was a quote in the document, right?
It was a quote in the document. That was what the document said.
And then the scope of the infiltration and the scope of the surveillance is jaw-dropping. Surveilling a Boy Scout troop because they had sent a letter, a pen pal letter, to another Boy Scout troop behind the Iron Curtain.
Right.
Surveilling women's rights groups, women's consciousness raising groups, as they were called then.
That's right. I mean, those kinds of activities were also immediately apparent. The Boy Scout letter you just described, surveilling every single student group on many of the, you know, and there are many colleges in the Philadelphia area. So surveilling all, you know, particularly the African-American groups that were active on campus in particular, but really everyone.
So then they take the documents and they photocopy them and send them off to newspapers.
That's right.
And that's when it all broke loose?
That's right. That's right. About 10 days after the break-in, they mail their first set of documents. And they send them to 3 journalists and 2 members of Congress. And ultimately, the Washington Post is the first and initially the only paper to publish a story about the stolen documents. But yes, I mean, that's an extraordinary story in and of itself that Betty Metzger, who was the journalist at the Washington Post who received the files, you know, that she then obviously went to authenticate the documents. When she started to read these documents, she thought, this is far-fetched. How can this be? Who would keep a record like this? I mean, they included that document about the paranoia that we just talked about. It turned out that was the easiest task for them. The Department of Justice was very keen to authenticate the documents and then tell them that they should not publish under any circumstances because it would endanger national security.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Joanna Hamilton. She's the director of a new documentary. It's called 1971, about a small group of activists who broke into an FBI office back in 1971, and they found documents that proved systemic spying and intimidation against Americans, civil rights activists, anti-war protesters. And when the Washington Post published these stories, what was the reaction?
Every other newspaper followed suit. It created a huge national uproar. In fact, the 2 members of Congress that they had sent the papers to had both returned them to the FBI. Perrin Mitchell, who was a congressman from Baltimore, had said he'd read the documents and he said, I think this deserves investigation. And George McGovern had returned them without saying anything and the following day held a press conference to say that the FBI was now, you know, the Federal Bureau of Intimidation.
And then there are Senate hearings. The Church Committee famously investigated.
That's right.
This.
So that happens a couple of years later. So this helps lead to the Church Committee hearings. In fact, there's sort of another important element of the story, precisely because the Pentagon Papers, I think, happens a few months later. Our story sort of fades from the headlines a little bit. I mean, the Pentagon Papers becomes the big deal, and then Daniel Ellsberg is caught, of course, and put on trial. But a year later, NBC's Justice Department's correspondent, Carl Stern, arrives on the Hill. And during the course of speaking to a few people, he's handed a sheaf of documents. And those were the media papers, which by this time, a year on, were widely disseminated. And immediately he spots on the top of one of the documents that the Citizens Commission had stolen, he spots a heading, COINTELPRO. It was from the Philadelphia office asking agents to write anonymous letters. And so Carl thought, you know, what right do FBI agents have to write anonymous letters? That's illegal. And so he decides to investigate has to file 2 lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act. And finally, they release 50,000 pages, which is really the beginning of the Church Committee's investigation.
And that's when you get all the details about how they sent these letters to Martin Luther King, for example.
Exactly right.
Intimidating him, suggesting he should commit suicide because of his extramarital affairs.
That's right. Absolutely.
Things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it certainly seems that this is another era. And that the pendulum does swing between interest in civil rights and interest in national security, and we're
right
in the camp of the latter at this point.
Yeah.
Do you think the pendulum will swing back?
Yeah, I mean, I think it inevitably will. I mean, it's hard to say. Obviously, it's a very dangerous world out there. There's no denying that. I do think that with the Snowden revelations, which happened just as at the tail end of when we were finishing the film, I do think that what Snowden has done is very similar to what they did back in the day. They ignited a national conversation that had never happened before. What Snowden did was ignite a similar conversation. Just simply, he gave us a window into what the government had been doing, and we hadn't had that conversation since September 11th.
The big difference, it seems to me, or one of the big differences, is that in 1971, this was all about J. Edgar Hoover. This was his vision. He controlled the FBI. And as you said earlier, he was all powerful. Now, it doesn't seem to need one particular person, that there is a vast apparatus, security spying apparatus.
Very true. The digital age.
And
yeah.
So in a sense, it might be harder to oversee something like that. That is so vast, and you know, it doesn't need a putative strongman at the top to lead it and guide it.
No, that's true. I do think, though, that, you know, the Senate Intelligence Committee was one of the elements that came out of the Church Committee hearings, was one of the reforms that were put in place, you know, so precisely the sort of oversight function. They recently released that report about torture that occurred over the past decade. And I think very few people would argue that having, you know, oversight is a bad thing. It's a good thing to know what is being done in your name.
So what happened to the activists who broke into that office in Media, Pennsylvania?
So there was a huge FBI manhunt. It was one of the largest FBI investigations ever, although you would never know about it because Hoover was so publicly embarrassed, he didn't really want anybody to know that there was this huge investigation going on. There were, you know, 150 agents that were looking for them, but they were never caught. They evaded capture all these years. They say that they were able to hide in plain sight, precisely because of the sheer number of active people who were active back in the day.
But that also seems extraordinary.
Absolutely.
Here's this FBI, which is all powerful, and couldn't find any of these people and arrest them.
Right. Seven of the eight were suspects. Interestingly, Bonnie, who we talked about earlier as having gone in to case the FBI office, was the only person who was never a suspect. And yet she was the only person that they had come face to face with. They had a sketch of her. They drew up this identikit, which they actually did not release to the media. They did not release it to the public. That would never happen today either.
Then I guess the statute of limitations has expired. So they're free to talk to anybody?
Yes, the statute on burglary and theft of government property expired after 5 years, and the FBI closed the case in 1976. But at the time, Hoover wanted to charge them with espionage, and that's a statute that never tolls. And now it would have been far-fetched because espionage has to do with foreign matters. Everything they leaked had to do with the FBI and was internal, domestic. But all that to say that when I was working on the film, we weren't sure how the government was going to react to them coming out. We were also releasing the film in an atmosphere where whistleblowers were being prosecuted. And then on the day of release, I mean, I worked in tandem with Betty Metzger, the journalist at The Washington Post. She wrote a book that came out last year called The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. It came out a tiny bit before the film, and on the day that her book was published, the FBI issued a statement. And that statement went along the lines of, you know, we're a different institution today than we were back in the 70s, partly as a result of the revelations from the 70s. So they didn't directly reference the burglary, but certainly referenced the Church Committee's investigations. You know, I think it's an open question whether the FBI is indeed a different institution. But at that point, we were very relieved.
Well, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Joanna Hamilton, director of the new documentary 1971, and it opens today at the Lemley Music Hall 3 in Beverly Hills. Well, hello, Warren Olney.
Hello there.
Tell us, what do we have in store for us?
Well, among other things, a very unusual voice. We're going to hear from an Arab citizen of Israel. The Arab vote might make a big difference in next Tuesday's election and prevent Bibi Netanyahu from getting enough votes to become the prime minister once again. And he would set a record, and it would be his fourth term. And we'll also hear a very interesting analysis, deep scientific research into whether conservatives or liberals are happier.
Wow. What? Yeah. Can you tell us? Or no, we have to tune in.
Of course not. I'm saving it for the show. You have to listen and find out.
Well, I wonder. What about moderates? Just moderately happy?
I don't know about the moderates. That's a good point. But if you look on our Facebook, you can see pictures of Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell that'll tell you which one is happier.
Neither one of them look very
by
happy
showing.
Normally.
Well, you have to check it out.
Okay. All right, Warren Olney and To the Point coming up at 1 o'clock. Thank you. And coming up on this show, our Friday film review segment this week, the new Scientology documentary, Cinderella, and the latest Liam Neeson action flick reviews next on Press Play.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so time to talk film. And in this in-between spring post-Oscars, pre-blockbusters period, we have really a genre film for everyone. We have a princess story, a Liam Neeson action film, and a documentary, Alex Gibney, Screed Against Scientology. Justin Chang is here. He's chief film critic for Variety. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Also, Tim Grierson, vice president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and a critic for Screen International and Paste. Welcome back.
Hello.
Let's start with Cinderella.
Who's this for? Is there someone we've forgotten?
It's my place.
Oh, it seems too much to expect you to prepare breakfast, serve it, and still sit with us. Wouldn't you prefer to eat when all the work is done, Ella? Or should I say Cinderella?
Okay, that's Cate Blanchett playing the evil stepmother and Lily James playing Cinderella. She was Cousin Rose in Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. So how Downton-esque is this, Justin?
Well, also the actress who plays one of her ugly stepsisters, not so ugly in this one, actually, but one of her, you know, unsavory stepsisters, I guess. I don't know the name of the actress, but she's in Downton Abbey. She plays Daisy.
Oh, Daisy, Daisy the cook.
It's Daisy the cook, yes, but their roles are reversed. I think this is a charming movie, actually. You know, maybe not the most madly inspired kind of retelling of the classic fairy tale. And of course, it very much, I think, references and draws upon our memories of the 50s animated classic. And I think
even that, down to the blue dress.
Even down to the blue dress. And, you know, Cate Blanchett, who we heard in the clip, pretty much steals the show as the stepmother, you know, and she really gives this wonderfully imperious, you know, kind of performance. You can imagine just from Cate Blanchett how good she is in this. So.
And just from the trailer, the costumes look incredible.
It's yeah. Gorgeous. Sandy Powell's the costume designer. Dante Ferretti, who's Martin Scorsese's production designer, did the art direction and everything. So I just think they brought the right measure of classicism to this, leavened with a little bit of modernization. It's not as aggressively modernized, perhaps, or updated as some of the fantasy films that we've seen from Disney in recent years, but they managed to make her a very appealing heroine who's not too milquetoast, but still stands up for kindness and courage and such. I really enjoyed it.
Tim?
I'm a little more mixed. I mean, I agree with Justin. It's definitely charming. And one of the things I really appreciate is that the movie, it's not about, remember, women, find a handsome man and marry him because that means happiness. I think the movie is actually much more progressive in terms of its gender politics without making a big deal out of it.
Perhaps not as progressive as Into the Woods.
Not so
Not so much.
It wears it.
But I will say, speaking of Into the Woods, I really miss Anna Kendrick, who is so great in Into the Woods. And also, frankly, Chris Pine. It's a different kind of take on that. But I think both of them have more charisma than the two leads in this version of Cinderella.
So this plays it straight. This is a straight Cinderella
story. It plays it very
story,
straight. There's no
glass slipper and all. And there'll be a little frozen
there is a frozen fever
aperitif
short
beforehand
in front of it, which threw the press audience that I saw it with into giddy delight. So
this is squarely aimed at young girls? Is that what this movie's
aimed
at?
It is. One thing about it, though, I notice is, you know, and because it's a live-action drama, it really kind of goes straight ahead with the parental death pile up in the in the opening minutes, and it really lets you get to, you know, unlike the Once Upon a Time, there was this, you know, Cinderella, and she's already orphaned. No, it's like you get to know the mother, you get to know the father, and then the little girl sitting behind me just was sniffling any time the specter of parental death kind of loomed, and I was sort of sniffling with her. So, but I kind of like that they don't shy away from that.
Yeah, that's it. It's definitely not too dark. I don't think it's going to traumatize. If they've seen Frozen and other sort of recent movies of the Disney sort of catalog, I think they'll be fine.
All right, let's move from the light into the dark. This is a Liam Neeson action film called Run All Night. Joel Kinnaman, the male star of The Killing, plays his son, and here's a clip.
One night, that's all I'm asking. Listen to your father for one night. If I can't figure this out by the morning, I'll walk myself into the precinct and tell him I blew those two officers away. One night, and you never have to see me again. One night.
Okay, Tim, here's Liam Neeson yet again playing an action star. He's, what, 62 years old now?
He's in his early
60s. Does he pull it off?
I have to say, as a Liam Neeson fan who likes him in this mode, I'm getting sort of tired. It's all set in one evening. It's him and his son, Joel Kinnaman, on the run from Liam Neeson's longtime friend, Ed Harris, who is a mob boss.
He wants to kill the son.
Yeah, it's sort of convoluted, but he wants to kill Liam Neeson's son. Liam Neeson wants to protect him. Liam Neeson and Ed Harris have a past. I think there's a lot of good sort of B-movie action set pieces in this. There's a great car chase. There's some great shootouts in it. But if we still live in a world where you recommend seeing as a rental as opposed to seeing something in the theater, I don't think it's sort of special enough, unique enough to sort of warrant seeing it in a theater. It's very stylish. It's the same director that he worked with Unknown and Nonstop. It's got certain moments, but I kept feeling like I've seen this movie already from him.
Justin, rent it, see it, or skip
it? Yeah, I don't disagree with Tim too much, but I guess I'm just easier to please this week anyways. I really like this movie, and in some ways I feel like it's, you could see it as recycling, and it is that. I haven't gotten tired of it yet, and I think that it does provide a sort of nice, smarter, more stylish alternative to the Taken franchise, which is just sort of running on fumes at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
And I do think that this is definitely a classier alternative to that.
So despite all of its tropes and its, shall we say, well-worn plot lines, it is still fun to see. And
it's fun. I found it tense and pretty gripping, especially early on. You know, by the end, you kind of know what's going to happen.
Someone's going to die.
And it features Common, long way from Selma, by the way, as a contract killer.
Okay. Maybe worth it for that alone. All right. Let's go to something completely different. Going Clear, the latest documentary from Alex Gibney, based on the book by Lawrence Wright. And it features lots of interviews with former Scientologists, including Paul Haggis. And you can hear a few of them in this trailer.
Someone had told me there's this cult and they'll make anything possible in your life.
I was deeply convinced that we were going to save the world.
It was a transcendent experience.
You feel euphoric.
Everything you do for endless trillions of years depends on what you do with and in Scientology.
Okay, Tim, what did you think?
I think what the movie does much better than that trailer suggests is that it doesn't do, I think, sort of the expected, ooh, Scientology, it's so scary. I think what Alex Gibney does really well in this film is he takes Scientology seriously enough to understand why the eight people that he interviews got so wrapped up in it. And I think that's important because you have to know why people would choose to join the church.
And do you come away with an understanding as to why?
I think it's still on a certain level a mystery that is very hard to penetrate. But this film, you know, some people have criticized this film for not giving us something that we don't already know, for not being as perhaps as layered and complex and revelatory as Lawrence Wright's book or even the New Yorker piece that he wrote. But I think it's so valuable what Alex Gibney has done, which is allow these people, these former Scientologists, to talk and take stock of what was I thinking and try, you know, and there's something extremely cathartic about watching that. And it's kind of funny because in a way they're sort of being audited on camera, but now they're purging these dark memories, you know, out of their system in one hopes and expects a much more productive kind of way.
So. Do you get the feeling at all that he pulled his punches because of the litigious reputation and nature of the church?
I think if anything, it helps because he doesn't do cheap shots because of it. I think this is one of his more sort of sober, somber, layered, intelligent film because I think he might have been concerned about that, honestly. And also real fast, the kind of the curiosity these people have that they still don't understand how they, you know, got sucked into the church. That, to me, I think is one of the fascinating elements of this movie, is that Paul Haggis, 30 years a Scientologist, he still can't articulate it. Why he was so sucked in. And to me, that's what's fascinating. I don't find that to be a fault in the movie, that these people still can't explain it.
And it's like, make no mistake, I mean, it is absolutely aimed against Scientology. This is not a measured, it's measured, but there's no two ways about it. And I think that he realizes, though, that for a subject like this, it was important to be as lucid and careful and well-reasoned as possible in terms of making his argument. And he makes it very, very well.
Okay, Going Clear in theaters today and on HBO beginning March 29th. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Justin Chang, Chief Film Critic for Variety, and Tim Grierson, Vice President of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association and also a critic for Screen International and Paste. Well, Christian Bordahl is here to round out the week in mailbaggery.
Yes, indeed. And I have to say, I'm definitely feeling the TGIF thing. I'm ready for the weekend.
And what are you going to do with yourself?
What am I going to do with myself? I'm going to lie on the couch.
You're going to watch Cinderella is what you're going to watch. I know you.
Well, speaking of Cinderella, funny you should say that, because we did ask our listeners, what other Disney films they think should be remade. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe we got some kind of cynical responses on this one.
No.
James Hippie says Disney should reprise The Shaggy D.A.
Yes.
Are you behind that one, Madeline?
I really did enjoy that.
I've never even heard of The Shaggy D.A. Turns out The Shaggy D.A. was a remake of another Disney movie made in 1959 called The Shaggy Dog.
Really?
Yes.
Fascinating.
In The Shaggy Dog, a kid gets turned into a dog because of a magic ring.
Uh-huh.
In The Shaggy D.A., the kid has grown up. He's an attorney. He's running for D.A. The ring gets stolen from a museum. Someone reads the inscription. He's turned back into a dog again. It sounds like a winner.
And then Liam Neeson comes out of the shadows.
And takes him out.
Yeah.
Adam Padilla says, don't redo The Jungle Book. And I kind of feel his pain there. I mean, they are redoing The Jungle Book. It's supposed to come out again next year. It's supposed to come out next year with Scarlett Johansson and Lupita Nyong'o. But I love The Jungle Book. Like, the music is so great. I just can't imagine how they can really do it justice. Anyway. And then Mike Shafanak asks how much Disney is paying us.
Us?
Yes.
Nothing.
Which, personally, Mike, I have to say, not enough. They've got to pick it up if they want more Disney from me anyway.
Exactly. So you won't be watching Cinderella, I guess. All right.
Have a great weekend, Madeline.
You too, Christian Bordahl. And you too, have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday. Stay tuned for Warren Olney and To the Point. Have a great weekend.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.